that's mediated by a massive spin two field. And now this is interesting for a couple reasons. The first is simply that if you're interested in infrared modifications of gravity, adding a mass to the graviton is probably conceptually one of the most naive and simple things that you can do. You start out with a massless field in GR, you want to change its low energy behavior. Introducing a small mass is the easiest way, conceptually at least, to do this. So an IR modification of GR. Which makes these theories interesting for cosmology. And in particular, a lot of recent interest in massive gravity has been in trying to address the cosmological constant problem, or at least gain some insight into the cosmological constant problem. But another reason why these theories are interesting is you can argue that it's sort of a basic field theoretic question. So can you, in fact, have a low-energy Lorentz invariant theory of a massive spin 2 field? And in fact, it's been notoriously difficult to obtain an interacting theory that has these properties. And this is interesting because we know that in the case of massless particles, right, we have these powerful no-go theorems that forbid interacting theories of massless high-spin particles, at least when you're in flat space. But we don't have such theories for massive particles, such theorems for massive particles. And yet, at the same time, writing down a consistent interacting theory of a massive spin 2 particle has been elusive for at least 40 years, if not longer. So it becomes an interesting field theory question. Can you even write down low energy theories that have these properties? All right, so what are the obstructions? Why has this been so difficult? So the starting point when we talk about a theory of massive gravity is we're going to start from the theory of a free massless spin 2 field. If you'll bear with me while I write out the Lagrangian. So this is just the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian linearized, so second order in the fields. And it takes the following form, minus 1 half d lambda h mu nu, d lambda h mu nu plus d lambda h mu nu, d nu, h mu lambda, minus d mu, h d nu, h mu nu, plus 1 half, d mu h, like so. So here, I'm expanding the metric, g mu nu, about Minkowski space, and I've canonically normalized the perturbation by a factor of 1 over mp, like so. All right, so this is the theory of a free massless spin 2 field. It enjoys a linearized diffeomorphism invariance. So this Lagrangian is invariant under the transformation delta h mu nu is equal to d mu psi nu plus d nu psi mu. And the reason why that linearized diff invariance is important is because it's responsible for taking the 10 independent components of h mu nu and restricting them down to 2 propagating degrees of freedom. So because of the linearized diff invariance, the 10 components of h mu nu, I can in fact get rid of eight of them, and I'm left with the 2 propagating degrees of freedom that we would expect for the massless spin 2. So these are just the 2 polarizations of the massless spin 2 field. All right, so now when I talk about massive gravity, what I mean is that I want to take this Lagrangian here, this quadratic Lagrangian, and I'm going to treat the Einstein-Hilbert part as the kinetic term, and now I want to add mass terms. So in other words, I want to add terms that contain no derivatives that are quadratic in the field. So I can add terms like m1 squared, h mu nu, and I can add terms like m2 squared, h squared, and that's it in terms of the free theory. Those are the only things I can add. So this is now the theory of a free massive spin 2 field. Okay, but the problem is, when you add terms like this to this action here, what you've done is you've explicitly broken this linearized diffeomorphism invariance. So these terms are not invariant under this linearized diff transformation. And because of that, you get extra degrees of freedom in your theory. All right, now at first glance, this isn't so bad, right? Because in fact, we do expect a massive graviton to have more degrees of freedom than the massless graviton. So we know that a massive particle of spin S, we can characterize it by its value of Sz. So massive particle of spin S, we can characterize by, say, the component of the spin in the z direction. And we know that this can take on all values, in all integer values in between plus s and minus s. So in particular, for a spin 2 particle, the massive graviton should have 2s plus 1 or 5 propagating degrees of freedom. All right, so we do expect there to be more propagating degrees of freedom for the massive spin 2. But how many do we actually have when we add a term like this? Well, one way, one nice way to count is that you can look at the equations of motion. So let me consider, first of all, the linearized equations of motion for the free theory. So for the free massless spin 2, my Einstein's equations are simply linearized Einstein tensor. G mu nu is equal to 0. And because of the linearized diff invariance, there's a Bianchi identity of the linearized theory, right? Just G mu nu is equal to 0. So this follows automatically from the fact that the kinetic piece here does have this linearized diff invariance. All right, so now, if I look at the massive equations of motion, I can use this Bianchi identity to get rid of the g mu nu on the left-hand side of the equations of motion. So for the massive spin 2, if I act on both sides of the equations of motion with this d mu, what I find now instead is a constraint. So m1 squared d mu h mu nu plus m2 squared d nu h is equal to 0. Simply because of this Bianchi identity here. All right, now this, in fact, represents four constraints, right? So if I apply that to my 10 components h mu nu, what I'm left is I start with 10 minus 4 constraints, and I'm left with 6 propagating degrees of freedom. All right, so I'm close, but I have one too many degrees of freedom than what I would expect for the massive spin 2 field. All right, and this extra degree of freedom, besides being a problem just because it's one too many, in fact, you can show that generically it's always a ghost. It has the wrong sign kinetic term. And so this theory with this generic mass term here is in fact unstable and not a consistent theory. All right, so what can you do? So you need to find a theory that has an additional constraint that removes this extra degree of freedom. And so this theory was written down in 1939 by Fiertz and Pauli. And it takes the following form. So the Fiertz-Pauli mass term, the full Lagrangian, is the Lagrangian of quadratic Einstein-Hilbert, and then minus 1/2 m squared h mu nu, minus h squared. So you're just choosing particular values of these coefficients, m1 and m2 here, relative to each other. All right, and what happens is that when you pick the coefficients to be of that form, what you find is, in fact, there's an additional constraint in the theory, in addition to these four constraints. So if you take the equations of motion for the linear massive spin 2 field, in addition to finding these divergence constraints, you can also find a trace constraint as well from taking the trace of the equations of motion. And what you're left with is a constraint of the following form, m squared h is equal to 0. All right, so that extra constraint is responsible for giving you
The correct. By propagating.
Degrees of freedom of a massive graviton. All right, so this is the Fiertz-Pauli theory. It's been around since 1939. It's a non-interacting theory of a massive spin 2 field. What you can do then is you can ask about phenomenology in this theory. So is this theory, can this be a viable theory of gravity? So one of the simplest things that you can do is just take this linearized theory here. So we want to look at phenomenology. And you can consider the potential due to a point source in this theory. So let me introduce some point source of mass m. And let me calculate v outside this source using this theory here. And what you find is that v of r is equal to minus 4/3 gm over r e to the minus mr, like so. All right, and this is to compare with the massless case, right? We just simply have v of r is equal to minus gm over r. So the two differences are the following. You get the Yukawa type form of the potential, which is precisely what you would expect by introducing a mass to this field. So now at distances that are large compared to the inverse mass of the graviton, the potential dies off exponentially. But the issue also is that you have this extra factor of 4/3 that appears in your theory that didn't appear in the linear theory. So in other words, if you start with the massive gravity theory and you take the m goes to 0 limit, you'd be off from the massless case by a factor of 4/3.
Just change the value of g.
Very good. You could just change the value of g. However, this potential here is precisely for non-relativistic sources. If you do the same thing for relativistic sources, you don't get the factor of 4/3. So if you adjust in g here, then you would get the wrong bending of light by a factor of 4/3. And therefore, this theory could be ruled out already by solar system observations. All right, so this is what's known as the VDVZ discontinuity. And it's problematic for two reasons. So first of all, it's telling us that linearized massive gravity is not a viable theory of massive gravity in our universe. And secondly, it's a little bit disconcerting because it's telling you that in principle, we can tell the difference between a theory in which, between a universe in which the mass of the graviton is arbitrarily small versus a universe in which the mass of the graviton is identically zero. So that's a little bit strange as well, but that's more of an aesthetic problem than a phenomenological problem. All right, but it turns out that there's a potential resolution to both these problems here, and this is what was pointed out by Weinstein in the 70s. So Weinstein argued that if you take this linear theory of gravity here and you start adding non-linearities to it, so terms of order h cubed and higher, and then you perform the same exercise, what you find is the following. So add non-linearities. Again, calculate the potential outside a source. And now what you find is that v of r, if you expand in r, is equal to minus 4/3 gm over r, 1 minus 1/6 gm over little m to the 4, r to the 5th, and so forth, expanding in this factor here, like so. So what that's telling you is that when you reach a radius rv, which is simply equal to this factor here, so which is equal to gm over m to the 4, all to the 1/5 power. When you reach this radius here, the nonlinearities in the theory start to become important. And then inside that radius, you can no longer trust this linear theory here. So in particular, if you send the mass of the graviton to zero, your Weinstein radius is going to become infinite, and there's going to be no regime in which you can actually trust the linear theory. You need to know what the nonlinear theory is in order to calculate this potential. More practically, if we just look at our solar system, and we can calculate, say, the Weinstein radius for the source, a source that's roughly equal to one solar mass, and I'm also going to put the graviton mass to be roughly equal to the Hubble scale, since that's what we're usually interested in for cosmological applications. If you calculate the Weinstein radius for this system, what you find is that RV goes like 10 to the 18 kilometers, so roughly the size of our galaxy. So what this means is that if you had a nonlinear theory of gravity, then you could only trust the linear regime outside of our galaxy. And inside of our galaxy, you would need to know what the nonlinear theory was in order to be able to compute the potential and to see if it agreed with observations or not. Okay, so the moral is that a nonlinear theory of gravity can potentially resolve this phenomenological issue. But remember that for the linear theory, we had to do some special tuning already at the linear level in order to give us a constraint that would eliminate an extra degree of freedom that came about because we had broken diff invariance. So the question becomes, so is there a nonlinear theory of massive gravity that exhibits the Weinstein mechanism that is potentially recovers general relativity at short distances? And if there is, does it maintain this additional constraint at the fully nonlinear level and thus propagate the right number of degrees of freedom? So in fact, in a paper in 1972, Bulwer and Deser argued that no, in fact, generically, this is not the case, that any nonlinear theory of gravity is always going to violate this constraint and give you ghosts at the nonlinear level. And so that's why this extra degree of freedom came to be known as the Bulwer-Deser ghost. All right, but in the last few years, there's been some progress on this issue. And in fact, loopholes in the original arguments of Bulwer and Deser were pointed out. And people were, in fact, able to construct nonlinear theories of massive gravity that do, in fact, have an additional constraint at the fully nonlinear level and therefore avoid this ghost problem. So this was work in 2010 and 2011. By Durham, Gabadadze, and Tolley. And what they found were ghost-free Lorentz invariant nonlinear massive gravity theories. All right, so I'm going to write them out here. I'm going to write them in a different form than they were originally introduced. So I'm going to write them out using the language of tetrads and forms, because it turns out that it's much easier to express these theories in that language rather than in the usual metric language. So what I'm going to do is the following. For my metric g mu nu, I'm going to introduce the tetrad e mu a in the following way. And corresponding to this tetrad, I'm going to introduce a tetrad 1 form, EA, which is equal to E mu A dx mu. In addition, I'm going to introduce a background or reference tetrad, which I'm going to call G bar mu nu. So this is just a fixed metric that appears in the theory. In order to get a Lorentz invariant theory, this reference metric is usually taken to be Minkowski. However, if you're willing to have non-Lorentz invariant theories, you can take it to be something else. So G bar mu nu is going to have a tetrad E bar mu A, A to AB, and similarly, there's going to be a tetrad 1 form, E bar A, which is equal to E mu A, dx mu, like so. Okay, so then in terms of these variables, these massive gravity theories take the following form. So the action S is going to be equal to mp squared over 2 in 4 dimensions
I'm going to have the curvature 2 form RAB, wedge EC, wedge ED, with all the Lorentz indices contracted with an epsilon tensor, epsilon ABCD. So this is just the usual Einstein-Hilbert term. This is nothing other than minus root GR, but just expressed in terms of a curvature 2 form and the tetrad 1 forms. There's going to be another piece I can introduce that looks like lambda, EA, wedge EB, wedge EC, wedge ED, epsilon AB, CD. Again, this is nothing more than the known term. This is just a cosmological constant. This is root G, lambda, but expressed in terms of wedge products and tetrads. And now the mass terms are going to take the following form. So there's going to be a minus M1 squared, EA wedge EB wedge EC wedge E bar D, so using one of the non-dynamical reference tetrads, epsilon ABCD. And basically all the other mass terms are just the different ways of wedging together the dynamical tetrads with the non-dynamical tetrads. So there's going to be an M2 squared, EA wedge EB wedge E bar C wedge E bar D, epsilon ABCD. And there's also going to be an M3 squared, EA wedge E bar B, wedge E bar C, wedge E bar D, epsilon A B C D, like so. And in principle, you could also add a term that's four non-dynamical guys wedged together, but this is, in this language, this is a purely non-dynamical term and won't contribute to the equations of motion at all. So this is what's often referred to as the two-parameter family. Of massive gravity actions. And the reason why it's called a two-parameter family is that in addition to the Planck mass and the cosmological constant, you can absorb one of these three m's into the definition of the mass of the graviton, so into little m. And then if you factor it out of the other terms, you're left with two independent parameters, which are often called alpha 3 and alpha 4, so two independent dimensionless parameters. And so those are all the free parameters that this theory has. All right, so this is what the ghost-free Lorentz invariant theory, nonlinear theory of massive gravity, looks like. It does, for a wide range of these parameters here, seem to exhibit a Feinstein mechanism, which makes it potentially a phenomenologically viable theory. And people have done a lot of work studying solutions and cosmology, and I'm not going to go into that because I want to talk about partially massless. But are there any questions about this before I go on? Okay. All right. So if this is also well and good, why am I interested in this theory called partially massless gravity? So it's fair to say that despite these successes, there are still some outstanding issues for these theories of massive gravity. The main one being that there's apparent superluminal propagation. And the reason why people believe that is that if you take these theories and you take a certain high energy limit known as the decoupling limit, and you study the helicity zero mode of these massive gravitons, then they look very much like Galileans. They have the same interactions as Galileans, which are another well-studied modified gravity theory. And Galileans are known to have superluminal propagation around certain generic backgrounds. So because of that, it's believed that massive gravity could inherit this problem from the Galilean theory. However, it actually hasn't been demonstrated that this is indeed an issue for the massive gravity theory. Mostly people just assume it is for the Galilean theory, but we haven't found complete solutions in massive gravity that do indeed have superluminal propagation. Nevertheless, it does raise the following question. So first of all, is there indeed superluminal propagation in massive gravity? If so, does it mean these theories are acausal? So does it lead to acausality? So in fact, some people have argued that even though there might be superluminal propagation, that you can't necessarily, say, form closed time-like curves within the regime of validity of the low-energy theory, and therefore these might still be healthy theories at low energy, so that's another possible thing to check. And the third issue to check is, do these theories admit standard Lorentz invariant UV completions? Because superluminality and low energy theory is often taken as an indication that in fact this is not possible. So this is also an outstanding issue then for these theories as well. So these are all open questions. Yeah.
What's the technical instruction why is it not sufficient to show that in the decoupling limit there's superluminality? Why can I trace back that to superluminal propagation and massive gravity?
So I think that the solutions that give you the Galilean theories with superluminal propagation, if you go to the full massive gravity theory, they can't be extended to asymptotic infinity for some reason, because you're taking this limit in order to get those solutions. So it's not clear that, in fact, these are stable solutions of the massive gravity theory to begin with. Yeah. All right, so these are the main open questions. And another open question is still, what is the relevance of massive gravity for the old cosmological constant problem? So in other words, people have found cosmological solutions to these massive gravity theories that do in fact exhibit late time acceleration in the absence of a cosmological constant. This late time acceleration is technically natural because it's related to the mass of the graviton, and the mass of the graviton is itself technically natural because you get this restored diff invariance in the massless limit. However, this addresses the new CC problem, so it gives you late-time acceleration, but it doesn't say much about why the value of the cosmological constant is so low to begin with. So is there a massive gravity theory that might have something to say about the old CC problem as well? So this is a more speculative issue. All right, so in order to investigate this question and potentially avoid these questions here, we were compelled to look at this sort of exotic theory of massive gravity, which goes by the name of partially massless gravity. All right, so to study partially massless gravity, we're going to return to the linearized theory. So we're going to forget a second these DRGT nonlinear theories of massive gravity. We're going to return to the linear theory of massive gravity, but we're going to put it on a de Sitter background rather than putting it on a Minkowski background as we did before. So the action is going to take the following form. So the quadratic Lagrangian looks like the following. So now these are covariant, de Sitter covariant derivatives, H mu nu. Now there's an additional piece due to the commuting of some of these derivatives. So there's going to be a 3 capital H squared, H mu nu, minus 1/2 H squared, where this H is just the Hubble radius of the background de Sitter space. So H squared is equal to 1/12 R, which is equal to 1/3 lambda. And now we're also going to add the Fiertz-Pauli mass term to this theory. So in addition, there's going to be a 1/2 m squared h mu nu minus h squared. And the perturbation h now is expanded around the de Sitter background. So we have g mu nu is equal to g bar mu nu plus 1 over mp h mu nu, like so. All right, so at this level, this is nothing more than a free massive graviton on a de Sitter background. It propagates 5 degrees of freedom, just like in the flat case, because you still have the additional constraint.
There's no overall diffeomorphism invariance of this theory. The mass term breaks it, just like it does for the flat space-time theory. All right, but what's interesting about putting this theory on a de Sitter background is the following.
Before the reset, what's the connection between this and that? Can I think of this as being a special choice of parameters for that? Linearized from the city space?
Well, so when you linearize this, you just get the Fierce-Pauli theory. So in fact, if you took this E bar here to be a de Sitter E bar, you would in fact, this is the linearized theory that corresponds to this. What I'm gonna talk about is whether or not, so for a particular value of parameters, this theory has a gauge symmetry. What we wanna know is there a corresponding nonlinear theory that has a nonlinear gauge symmetry? That's a subset of this theory here.
So why isn't that? So the statement is that if I take this one, linearize around the Sitter space, I get that one.
That's right.
And the alpha 3 and alpha 4 don't appear anywhere.
Yeah, that's correct. They're all absorbed into M, basically. So alpha 3 and alpha 4 basically parameterize the nonlinearities of the theory. They're the different potentials, the different forms of the potentials you can have.
Also, if I went more than quadratic order, I'd start to see alpha 3.
That's right, that's right. Sure.
And what's, because you have an E bar, that means that you, when you say that your Lorentz invariant, that depends on, if I thought of E bar being like the bev of something, I would have thought of it as a sense in which I broke the Lorentz invariants, although you kind of still converted it back in.
That's right. So it's really only a Lorentz invariant theory if you take E bar to correspond to the Minkowski metric.
Right.
But you could have, say, a theory that has a de Sitter invariance if you take E bar to correspond to the de Sitter metric instead. I guess the only reason I made a point about this being Lorentz invariant is that we've known for a while how to write down Lorentz breaking theories of massive gravity that don't have a ghost problem. Whereas this theory here, when you take E bar to correspond to the Minkowski metric, it could be Lorentz invariant, yeah. All right, so if we take this linearized theory on de Sitter, and we pick the following for the mass, so we choose our parameter such that m squared is equal to twice h squared, what happens is that this theory actually exhibits a scalar gauge symmetry. And in particular, it's invariant under the transformation delta h mu nu is equal to d mu d nu plus h squared d bar mu nu phi, like so, where again these are de Sitter covariant derivatives. H is the Hubble constant associated with the background de Sitter space, and this is the de Sitter background metric as well. So for this particular choice of gauge of parameters of the theory, we get an enhanced symmetry at this point. And what the symmetry does is it's responsible for removing the helicity zero mode of the massive graviton. So away from this point here, you have a theory of massive gravity that propagates 5 degrees of freedom, helicity plus minus 2, plus minus 1, and 0. At this point here, you have a scalar gauge symmetry, so you only propagate the helicity plus minus 2 and helicity plus minus 1 degrees of freedom. So in fact, you can plot it out. A nice little graph you can make in parameter space. So let's make my y-axis be h and my x-axis be m, like so. So when m squared is equal to 0, that's just when I have usual massless linearized gravity. So that corresponds to this line on my graph here. And I get a theory that propagates 2 degrees of freedom. If I have m squared less than 2h squared, so if I draw a line, say, along here, then in fact, the helicity zero mode develops a wrong sign kinetic term, and this is an unstable theory. Whereas if m squared is greater than 2h squared, I propagate 5 healthy degrees of freedom of the massive graviton. And now what we're saying is that precisely at this point, where m squared is equal
to 2h squared,
and you get a theory that propagates 4 degrees of freedom.
Does this correspond to an irreducible representation of the De Sitter group?
Yes, exactly. So this is one of the irreducible representations of the De Sitter group. Uh-huh. Yeah.
How do you say what that is?
Yeah, you can. So you have the De Sitter Casimirs rather than Casimirs of the Poincaré group, but they correspond. This corresponds to a special value of one of the mass-like De Sitter Casimirs. Yeah. There's papers by Higuchi where he Euclideanizes De Sitter, and then he looks at those representations and he finds this representation here.
Mm-hmm. I remember many years ago, people did representations of the De Sitter and anti-De Sitter groups to classify the particles the way you do with flat space with mass spins. And for any spins, there were short multiplets that happened for special values of some of the choice vectors. Is that what we're seeing here? Is this m squared equals 2a squared?
I believe that's what it is. I think that's right.
Is it known whether this same property will hold if we perturb the sphere a little bit or not?
So then you start talking about nonlinearities in the theory, because at the linear level, you're really expanding around this fixed De Sitter background that's non-dynamical. If you want to talk about moving away from De Sitter, I would say that would be equivalent to introducing nonlinearities in the theory, and then it's not clear whether the symmetry is going to hold or not.
Excuse me.
Yes.
So usually from just the perspective of representations of the Sitter space, there's something called the depth associated with the partially massless. So how do you see that in the parameters?
Yeah, so for the spin 2, in fact, there's only one depth. Uh-huh. So there's only one gauge symmetry that gets rid of the helicity zero mode. If you go to higher spin, you also have partially massless theories with more depth. So like if you look at spin 3, the maximal depth one, you just get rid of the helicity zero mode. But there's also a different set of parameters where you can get rid of the helicity 1 and the helicity zero mode as well. And that would be a different depth. Sorry.
That the depth corresponds to having just the scalar diffeomorphism.
Yeah, so maximal depth is usually just the scalar. Just the scalar. And for spin 2, you only have the maximal depth theory. No, there's no for spin 1. This the partially massless starts at spin 2. Yeah. So it's the first instance.
Is that this is phenomenon of short multiplets that that did happen? And is there always a question of what you meant by a massless thing in the Sitter space?
I think that's a probably coupled masses.
Well, there was one option, but for scalars you have a conformally coupled, you have a Boltzmann mode, or even for low spins, there's always this issue as to what was the special case.
I see, but you're saying there is a short multiplet for this
spin? Well, I can't remember.
Okay.
For spin 1, you're either going to have 2 degrees of freedom, which is a massless case, or 3 degrees of freedom, which is a massless case, right?
Yeah.
There's no in between.
Yeah.
Degrees of freedom.
And what was, sorry, Ryan, where does that go? What was the connection between that and then?
No, well, so there's massive and massless, right? But there's no degree of freedom counting that would.
Well, the mass, that's the thing, is massive.
Like the degree of freedom counting tells you that there can't be anything in between.
Well, the thing was that mass is a subtle thing in the Sitter space because you don't really have that as one of your Casimirs. And so the shortness of these representations, one argument people made was that that would be a special thing that would choose what was special in the analog of masses.
Right.
Standard is the zero curvature limit. So it's massless. In the zero curvature limit, it becomes a massless, a helicity of Poincaré. And that would be the conforming coupled massless groups. So what would happen to these in the zero curvature limit?
So you would want to take the zero curvature limit in such a way that you stay on this partially massless line. And so what you would end up with is a theory with zero mass and zero curvature.
So yeah, it's in this Wigner-Noether contraction procedure that this. That these have to be smooth limits. So that's the problem with like the minimally coupled fields of higher velocities, that they don't have a good zero curvature limit. So that's why you choose mass to be a massless to be conformed with other masses. And they will be the short representations.
Right, but if I'm thinking of short representations being the analog, the generalization of special, that there's fewer degrees of freedom in the representation, then it sounds like I would have expected that to exist for spin 1, but you're saying that can't be the right picture because the thing you're describing here only happens.
That's right.
So I think the one we usually call massless, the 2 degrees of freedom, is also must also be a short representation,
yes.
Right? And then what happens is that there's two short representations for spin 2, one short representation for spin 1. the short representation for spin one is just the thing with the normal gauge invariance.
So this this short one here then is better than, so in the spin two case, what's the statement? That there's two short representations and they have the same dimension, or there's one that's smaller than the other?
No, there's the math, there's the dimension, the one with 2 degrees of freedom, right? And
okay.
Then there's the one with
I see.
All right, so why is this theory attractive if we're interested in massive gravity? So first of all, we believe that to good approximation, we do live in De Sitter space, so why not consider representations of the De Sitter group when we're looking for IR modifications of gravity? Perhaps a more compelling argument is the absence of this scalar degree of freedom. So the scalar mode was what was responsible, in fact, for this VDBZ discontinuity that we found earlier. So it's because when you take the massless limit, the helicity zero mode sticks around and it remains coupled to the trace of the stress tensor, and that's what gives rise to this extra force that gives you the VDBZ discontinuity. So in a theory where you have no helicity zero mode to begin with, then you have no VDBZ discontinuity, you have no need for a Weinstein mechanism and no strong coupling, so no helicity zero means no VDBZ. Weinstein or strong coupling. It's also a way to avoid these issues of superluminality. Again, the reason why we think that there's superluminality in these massive gravity theories is tied to the behavior of the helicity zero mode in this decoupling limit. If you don't have the helicity zero mode to begin with, there's no reason you would necessarily be worried about superluminality in these theories as well. So. And finally, a nice thing about these theories is that you now have a gauge symmetry that ties the mass of the graviton to the background De Sitter curvature of the theory. So this is protected because you have an enhanced, this relationship is protected because you have an enhanced symmetry at that point. So what that means is that potentially, if you were able to come up with a nonlinear, partially massless theory, so a theory where you have nonlinear interactions that have some, that maintain some nonlinear gauge symmetry as well, you would have a theory in which potentially the value of the cosmological constant was tied to the mass of the graviton, which in turn is itself a technically natural parameter. So it hints that this might be an interesting way of addressing the old CC problem through this partially massless symmetry. Okay, this is very vague. We don't have this in principle, but that's, we don't have this in practice, this nonlinear theory, but that's a motivation for looking for a nonlinear theory. So symmetry ties the value of the CC to the mass of a graviton, which is, in turn, technically natural. All right, so for the past couple of years, we've been looking for a nonlinear completion of this partially massless theory. So what we want to do is basically the same thing that DRGT did for linearized Fierce-Pauli theory. We want to find a nonlinear theory that has a gauge invariance that continues to eliminate the helicity zero mode at the fully nonlinear level. And what we found is one after another no-go theorems that say that this doesn't work. So in particular, we know that among the DRGT nonlinear massive gravity theories, there's no nonlinear partially massless theory, so you can't just pick the values of those parameters with a De Sitter reference metric and get a partially massless theory. We can also show more generally now that, in fact, there's no nonlinear two-derivative theory that has a nonlinear partially massless symmetry. So we have no goes for the nonlinear theory.
If you had a linearized level and you had matter, and you tried to extend that symmetry to the matter sector, is it known how to do that?
Yeah, so it's you can do it for sure for non-dynamical matter, so that all that needs to happen is that you need to have some t mu nu that obeys d mu, d nu, plus h squared d mu nu t mu nu is equal to 0. And it's possible to come up with non-dynamical matter sectors that obey this property. I mean, for one, you can just have a conserved and traceless matter source, and that's going to satisfy this property as well. We're less sure how to couple this to dynamical matter.
We're in, but it's scale invariant dynamical matter would work.
Scale invariant dynamical matter should work. But more generically, we're unsure. Okay, so we have a series of no-goes for the nonlinear theory, including any two-derivative Lagrangian. So it's possible still that there are more exotic higher derivative theories that do exhibit this nonlinear partially massless theory, partially massless symmetry. But in the meantime, what this seems to be telling us is that the partially massless theory has more in common with a spin 1 field than it does with a spin 2 graviton, massive or massless, in the sense that it seems to be a theory that only contains, or that has no self-interactions. And in fact, there are other reasons to support this connection. 10 minutes. This relationship between the partially massless spin 2 and the spin 1 theory. And so in fact, that's what I wanted to talk about today, are those relations. All right, so what are the connections between the partially massless spin 2 and spin 1? So for one thing, it contains a one derivative field strength that is invariant under the partially massless transformation. So in particular, there's an F mu nu lambda, which is equal to d mu h nu lambda minus d nu h mu lambda, and this by itself is invariant under the partially massless transformation, dh mu, d mu plus h squared phi, like so. It also exhibits an electromagnetic duality. So in the same way that electromagnetism is invariant under the transformation, delta F mu nu is equal to F tilde mu nu, where this is the dual field strength. You have the free linear partially massless Lagrangian also exhibits an invariant under delta F mu nu lambda is equal to F tilde mu nu lambda, where this is a dual field strength to this guy here, and it's dualized in the following way. Let me skip ahead. So it's dualized just in the first two indices. So F tilde lambda mu nu equals 1/2 epsilon mu nu rho sigma F rho sigma lambda. So the equations of motion for the linearized theory. Well, okay, let me write it in the following way. So you have this one derivative field strength, F mu nu lambda. You can use that to re-express the Lagrangian over there. So in fact, the Lagrangian L is in fact just equal to 1/4 F mu nu lambda, minus 2 F lambda, where F lambda is just F mu nu with the second two indices contracted, like so. All right, so from this form of the Lagrangian, you can show that it's invariant under this duality transformation. The equations of motion written in terms of these Fs are equal to D F tilde mu nu lambda equals 0 and F lambda equals 0. Whereas at the same time, you have Bianchi identities that look like d nu f mu nu lambda equals 0 and f tilde lambda equals 0. So these are the equations of motion. And
identities are the Bianchi identities. So we can see that in the absence of sources, this duality just rotates the equations of motion with the Bianchi identities in the same way that it does for the usual electromagnetic duality. And finally, so you can find like electric monopole type solutions in these theories, and also magnetic monopole type solutions. But what's interesting is that even though you only have a scalar gauge symmetry in this theory, there's a surprisingly rich structure of gauge charges. So just very quickly, I want to discuss what the charges actually are in this theory, because it's somewhat non-trivial. All right, so we know that when we have a global symmetry, we have Noether's theorem, which tells us that conserved charges are in one-to-one correspondence with the global symmetries of the theory. These are generically going to be one-form symmetries. And what I mean by that is they can be expressed as some d mu j mu is equal to 0 on the equations of motion. This leads to a conserved charge. Q, which I can define as the integral of j over a 3 surface. And what conservation is telling me is that the value of Q doesn't change when I deform what the 3 surface looks like. So I can move around this 3 surface, and I still get the same value of Q, like so. So it turns out that the story is a little bit more complicated when instead of global symmetries, you have gauge symmetries instead. So with gauge symmetries, instead the conserved charges are in one-to-one correspondence with what are known as reducibility parameters of the gauge symmetry, and I'll define what I mean by this in a second. Instead of being one-form symmetries, they're two-form, or can be two-form, or higher symmetries, which means that instead of d mu j mu equals 0, it's d mu j mu nu is equal to 0 on shell. The conserved charge Q, I can define as the integral of J, now integrated over a 2 surface instead. And conservation is telling me now that the charge that I get is independent of how I deform this 2 surface around a given charge, like so. Sorry? I think this is still true in curved space as well. Yeah, it should still be true in curved space. Okay, so just to go through quickly how this plays out for electromagnetism.
So when you say curved space, it's curved but asymptotically the sitter space?
So you want there to be, I think as long as it's asymptotically flat or asymptotically de Sitter, what you want is that the reducibility parameters should be well-defined asymptotically. And as long as that holds, it shouldn't matter if you're in flat space or in curved space.
I know the normal Q story, that's, you're moving the surface around, but you're nailing it down and maybe just to be a Sitter transformation or something.
That's right.
But in this case where you've got a two-form, how do you get that surface? Is that surface getting up to infinity, or is that surface in the interior somewhere?
Yeah, so let's see. I guess if you're in De Sitter, I can Euclideanize and draw De Sitter like this. And so if I have, a point charge here, then what I'm saying is this surface around the point charge I can deform in any way, like this, and it shouldn't matter whether I'm asymptotically de Sitter or not.
It's just, I mean, it's the usual statement that, I mean, we can do electromagnetism in the sitter, right? And I can have a localized point charge. And if I want to calculate the charge enclosed in a volume, it doesn't matter where I draw that sphere, even though I'm asymptotically a sitter. That's the statement. Okay, yeah.
Is the ADM mass like an example of this?
Or? Yeah, very good. So that's precisely what the ADM mass is for if you apply this to diff invariants. Okay, so what we mean by reducibility parameter. Is a gauge parameter for which the gauge transformation is zero. So, for example, for electromagnetism, our gauge transformation takes the form delta A mu is equal to d mu lambda. What this means is that the reducibility parameter corresponds to the equation d mu lambda is equal to zero, which is only satisfied by lambda equal to a constant. So that's our reducibility parameter. The conserved two form, in this case, is nothing other than f mu nu itself. So j mu nu is equal to f mu nu. And we have that on shell, d mu f mu nu is equal to zero. And then the conserved charge is nothing other than the electric charge. So Q is equal to the integral of F over a two surface, and I'm free to deform this two surface however I see fit. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to identify what are the conserved charges for the partially massless theory. And it turns out to be surprisingly non-trivial. So for the partially massless theory, our gauge symmetry is given by dH mu nu equals d mu d nu plus h squared d bar mu nu phi. And so the reducibility parameters are going to correspond to solutions of phi so that this is equal to zero. All right, now it turns out that you can re-express this equation here in terms of the embedding coordinates. So if I consider a de Sitter hyperboloid, say in 4 plus 1 dimensions, and let me call these coordinates of the embedding space A, B, C, et cetera, it turns out that this expression here corresponds to dA, dB, phi, is equal to 0. So that the solution to this expression here, to this equation here, is nothing other than the coordinates in the embedding space. So for example, if I decide to work in static coordinates, so first of all, I'm always going to find five conserved charges, one for each coordinate of the embedding space. If I work in static coordinates, they're going to take the following form. So phi 0 equals 1 over h, 1 minus h squared r squared, sinh ht. Phi 1 is 1 over h, 1 minus h squared r squared, cosh ht. And then the rest are the angles. So r cos theta, r sine theta cos phi, and so forth. So there are, in fact, five conserved charges associated with this single gauge symmetry here. Now, really what we want to do is we want to have an invariant notion of charge, or the Sitter invariant notion of charge. And it turns out that of these five charges, there are two, well, the de Sitter invariant is going to correspond to the norm of this vector here, and there are two possibilities for that norm. It can either be space-like or it can be time-like. And so there are two, in fact, invariant charges associated with the partially massless symmetry. And we can see how that plays out when we look for solutions. But before I go to that, I also need to introduce the conserved two form. So J mu nu corresponding to each charge. So let me call these guys this index capital I, where I runs from 0 to 4. So J mu nu I is equal to F mu nu lambda d lambda phi I, like so. All right, so here it takes on a slightly more complicated form than just for the electromagnetic case, where it was just the field strength alone. And I should say, technically, for the electromagnetic case, the conserved current, this is actually F mu nu times lambda. But because lambda is always a constant, we usually drop it out, or we absorb it into the electric charge here. Whereas here, we're keeping around the 5 phi. OK, so if I can look for electric monopoles in this theory. So in other words, I want to find point-like solutions that carry these charges here. If I start out with a spherically symmetric ansatz, what I find, in fact, is that there's no time-independent spherically symmetric solution. And in fact, you have to introduce time dependence. So the simplest spherically symmetric source that we can write down takes the following form. 1 over 4 pi, q naught cosh ht minus q1 sinh ht. And then this gets multiplied by a matrix that depends on functions of h and r on the diagonal, like so, which I won't write out all the way. OK, but what's interesting is that even though you have this time-dependent solution, if you take this and you plug it in to find the conserved current, what you find, of course, is something that's time-independent. So now let me take, so this is just a spherically symmetric solution to the partially massless equations of motion in vacuum. If I take this solution and I plug it into this J, I find that J mu nu 0. So for the first charge here, this gives me zeros on the diagonal. And then I have minus q naught over 4 pi r squared plus q naught over 4 pi r squared and zeros everywhere else. And J mu nu 1, I get the same thing but with q1 instead of q0. So zeros. And then minus q1 over 4 pi r squared, q1 over 4 pi r squared. So indeed, when I take these currents and I integrate them over a two surface, I find a time-independent charge, as I would expect. That's clearly independent of the surface that I'm integrating over. So even though you have this very complicated time-dependent looking solution, the charges associated with the solution are quite simple.
Can you smooth it out so you don't have a singularity and still have the same story but through word?
Yeah, so you can. So this is just for point type solutions, but you can find more dispersed solutions as well. Yeah. Okay, and then you can find the analog of magnetic monopoles for this theory. So you can ask basically what gauge potential can you write down? What h mu nu can you write down so that f tilde gives you the f that you would get from this theory? And in that way, you can look for magnetic monopole type solutions. So the other j's are non-zero, but when you integrate them over the surface, the integral becomes zero. Yeah. But just to summarize what we found here, so in fact, so the q naught and the q1, you can identify with the invariant charges, the de Sitter invariant charges that are coming from the norm of this vector here. And what's interesting about these charges is that you can take, say, the flat space limit of this theory. So take the limit where you send h to 0 and m to 0 in the same way. And what happens to these two charges is that you can, in fact, identify them with mass and with electric charge. All right, so here, they look more or less on equal footing. But the interesting thing is that in the flat space limit, one of them looks like a mass and the other one looks like an electric charge. All right, so just to summarize, so this is a simple linear theory, linear free theory, that exhibits a remarkably rich structure of gauge charges. Of course, at the end of the day, we would be interested in having partially massless gravity be a viable theory of gravity. And in order for that to happen, we would want these theories to have nonlinear interactions. One remaining hope that we're looking at is the possibility of having Yang-Mills type interactions for these theories, given that they do resemble, they do have more similar properties with spin ones than with other spin twos, but that's still an open question. So I'm over time, I'll stop here. Thank you.
Hey, before we take a few quick questions for Rachel Thorne, there will be dinner in the bistro, say around 6, with Rachel, if you're able to make it, and students and postdocs at Stanford, as usual. So any questions?
Yeah.
So what happens when you look at the phenomenology of this theory, just as a linear theory?
Yeah, so it looks a lot, I mean, just a linear theory, gives you something that looks a lot just like linearized gravity, especially because you're taking the mass to be very small. The issue is how you're going to couple it to matter, but just coupling it to non-dynamical point sources, it very closely resembles linearized gravity, just usual linearized GR.
So there's nothing wrong with
it? Not at this level, yeah.
Not yet.
Not yet, exactly. There will be, probably.
Thank you.